Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons. Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric Morgan over there.
Hello.
That's Vanessa Williams over there.
Hello.
I'm Kelly Young. Hey, guys. How was your Christmas?
Delightful.
Yeah?
Absolutely
weird.
Delightful. Yeah, I was about to have a super, super weird Christmas that would have mirrored my Thanksgiving, where it would have been like my mom, my sister, me, and a bagged turkey, which, by the way, are not good. I accidentally bought a turkey you cook in a bag. It was disgusting. or so I'm told, because I didn't eat it. But I was told it was not good. And then I got invited to go out to Middle East.
Middle East.
But yeah, so it got to be like a slightly like three different human beings I'm used to staring at, so that was very exciting. I was like, I don't care what happens, the scenery outside looks slightly different. Brilliant.
And then you just got back and brought all of their germs to my house.
Everyone was COVID tested before we went.
What?
Yeah. It was a COVID-free Christmas.
Wow. I like it.
Yeah.
Impressive.
So the last COVID test I got was a really deep one. Went all the way back. I didn't know that it went that far. Like my nose. It went all the way and then they counted to eight. And I was like, there's something wrong. So that was refreshing.
Are you like, do you guys smell oranges? What is that?
Like my eyeballs are being scratched. Such an interesting feeling. So how about you guys? How was your Christmas?
Well, I was able to do a socially distanced Christmas with my family. In a much smaller capacity than normal. Yeah. But it was nice because I hadn't seen anybody in forever. And It was just really nice to see him. My mom got her first vaccine shot like 2 days before.
What?
And nice. She's, a daredevil now. She's like, I'll see you guys later. I got to go to the mall. I got to do all this stuff. I don't think it quite works that way,
Mom.
You got to
tell her, yeah, she's got to get number two and then she can do it.
Oh, I did say that. She schooled me on that. Kelly, number two is a booster. You're getting 70%. Most of the stuff is happening in this first shot.
Good to know.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, Mom.
Okay, wow. So you had a 30% chance of still getting it then.
Just fine for somebody who has, lived such a good life and, nothing can knock you over when you're that age.
My mom's like, look, I'm probably going to drop dead in the next year or two anyway, and I'm not going to, let it happen without seeing my family.
Yeah,
so.
I get that.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, we just separate houses. Dina and I got back in cars and brought it to her brother's house and then brought presents to her parents and talked to each of them for a little bit, but... And did his horribly awkward Zoom call the night before where we opened like stocking style presents on Christmas Eve. Yeah. It's like, how are we doing this? What order do you want to go? Are we going to do it? Should we all open at once?
Like, so weird. Yeah, there was a little bit of that in mine as well, where you're like, the signal's coming in and out, and you're holding the thing going, thank you.
Yes.
And you're like, looking like, do you like it? Yes, I do.
This is definitely one for the books.
Oh, yeah. No joke. When everybody's family portrait this year is like everybody on a Zoom call,
yes.
We've got like four or five of those like kicking around now. It's just so weird.
It's beginning to look a lot like COVID.
Everywhere you go.
Everywhere you go. Hey, guys, I woke up so excited on Christmas morning. Not for presents. No. For Wonder Woman 1984 on Disney Plus.
Oh, I'm Disney Plus.
Or HBO Max.
Yeah, sure. I do that all the time, too. I keep going to HBO Max and going, where's The Mandalorian? Oh, shit. No,
it's on. Totally. Now, I have not seen it. I will say that I'm going to watch it tonight. But I can only assume you loved it, and it was the best DC film you've ever seen.
Sure. What, are you a mind reader or something?
I know, right? I saw the trailer. I know what's coming. Amazing 80s action with, like, Chris Pine?
Guess what? If you saw the trailer, sure, and you think you know what's coming, and you think, I like what I saw in this trailer,
yeah,
you're going to be very, very disappointed.
Oh, dear. Well, you know what? Pedro's in it, and I can't wait to see him walk around a little bit.
He knows how to choose scenery. I'll give him that. I think he was horribly miscast.
Sure.
I'll say this. Gal Gadot is so beautiful, and it's such a good thing. Because I was staring at the screen. After about 25 minutes, I was like, oh, no. This is really, really bad. And I was really excited for this movie.
Yeah.
But you really liked the first one, right?
Until the ending, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because the ending, like the last 40 or so minutes, becomes a Marvel movie in my head. It like squishes into like a slightly different universe for Wonder Woman. But I still love that first one. Like, it was just such a cool movie in a lot of ways. But Gal Gadot, you know what? She is a stunning woman.
Yes.
So I'm excited to watch her in a variety of costumes for 80-some minutes or however long this movie is.
That is one of the problems, I think.
The costumes?
Yeah, you get to see her in a variety of costumes.
Oh. Were they, like, not canon?
I hope it wasn't the Wonder Woman costume you wanted to see her in.
Oh, no.
Because there's an hour-long stretch in the film where she is not in costume.
Well, I figured. I mean, because she's, like, a museum curator.
Right, but this is a Wonder Woman movie.
Well, yeah, but Justice League, she wasn't hardly in her outfit either.
I'll tell you, my biggest disappointment is they made a big, huge deal about, you know, Patty Jenkins said that third act of the first film was tacked on. That was studio interference, okay, all this stuff. They gave her carte blanche on this. She's a writer on it and the director.
Yikes.
And she shit the bed. So
yeah,
it's bad. Now, it's sitting fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, so your mileage may vary.
Yeah. I've seen mixed, but I've seen a lot of not real positive reaction to this one.
My entire Facebook feed is like furious fanboys. Like, I don't know a girl who's seen it yet, but all the dudes are like pissed. So
I will say this. If you're a woman and you're going to root for this because it's a female protagonist, a female filmmaker, and all of that stuff, mm-hmm, that's fine. But I think you should be angrier than me. You deserve better than this.
Right.
So
That's how I felt about some films that have come out by different female directors.
Ghostbusters. Guess I wasn't female director, but
yeah, it is sometimes like, hey, just because you're feeding us the food you think we like, it doesn't mean you cooked it right.
Yeah.
You know, like, and everyone's entitled to make a mistake. Absolutely. It's okay for some people to have their, you know, one of their films suck balls. That's fine. I don't think I'm not ready to dismiss her as a bad filmmaker.
Well, she's already got, is she doing the Star Wars, one of the Star Wars shows?
Is she?
Yeah, she's got the...
Hey, man, Star Wars will flip on a dime. There's a lot of people who lost Star Wars.
That's true, but Wonder Woman 3 has already been greenlit, so.
How do they figure out the money for this?
Well, this was a rental, unless you had HBO Max, and they shut down their free week stuff before.
Sure.
Yeah, so you had to sign up for it.
That's hilarious.
You had to rent it.
Oh, so HBO, they can tell. You rascals. And Eric, you haven't seen it, correct?
No, I actually haven't seen the first one. Not by dismissal. Really? I just haven't. I am Marvel. I'm a Marvel guy first.
Sure, yeah.
And I like the DC movies, but I haven't seen Aquaman. I haven't seen Wonder Woman. Some other one I haven't seen. I can't think of what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the Snyder Cut just because I can't imagine that movie can be saved.
But certainly not by adding time to it.
Right. Yeah, no kidding. Oh, I'm but curious.
Maybe a good color correct, and let's just get rid of all the scenes with the mustache removal, and maybe we'll be somewhere. Yeah, you know, actually, Aquaman, if you have zero expectations or negative expectations, it's a fun, stupid film. I had enough fun at it, just not zero expectations.
Well, I came across, because you know, I've been doing library borrowing of comic books. I've been reading a lot more comic books than I might normally, which is great.
That's awesome.
And I came across a more recent Aquaman. I don't know if it's a time of the film or before it. And it was amazing. It was a great Aquaman series, and I've never thought anything of Aquaman. But this one was really good. It even had a bunch of making fun of him. For the start of the comic was basically making people fun of being Aquaman. And all the stuff everybody always says about Aquaman. Hey, have fun talking to the fish. And all those jokes are brought up and dealt with. And it's really quite clever and fun.
Oh, that's like awesome.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty awful, but just like Gal Gadot, what's his name?
Oh, Jason Momoa.
Jason Momoa. That guy's easy to look at for long stretches of time.
You know what? I underestimated the Momoa. And man, could he save a film? I was shocked. I was like, I'm not even like a Jason Momoa like girl. Like, I know that there's like a club of women who adore him. And I was still like, you know what? Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for your service.
It was hard to believe that with Game of Thrones, they actually downplayed how beautiful he is as a guy.
I know.
I mean, he didn't look bad by any means, because I don't know if you can possibly do that to him. But then you put him in Aquaman and you go for the full big budget beautification.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
What a gorgeous. It was a weird pairing with, like having Nicole Kidman in it was a little odd, but whatever. Her bits were weird to me, but that's fine. Whatever. Nicole's fine.
Her bits?
Her bits don't look weird to me at all.
Hey, did you see anything?
Speaking of Nicole Kidman, I saw Prom.
Oh God, I watched that too.
Did you really?
Yeah. Dana and I watched it. Two nights ago, I think. We're like, hey, let's watch something stupid and mind-numbingly dumb.
Yeah. It was fun.
I was about 20 minutes in. I'm going, oh, boy. What are we doing here? Uh-huh. And then, what's his name? Gordon hit some song, I think, about coming out or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And he was so good. And from then on, the movie just became good. But, man, that first 20 minutes or so, I'm going, like when they were singing in the bar and stuff.
Yeah, and they're, kind of pompous.
Yeesh, this is not fun at all. But it's long. But anyways, what'd you think?
No, same. I mean, I actually, I'd heard the first part was really good. So I guess I just was like, okay, I'm in it. I already kind of know a little bit of what happens. And then, I liked a lot of it. I thought... there was a very Glee-like feeling to it, because it's by the guy who did Glee and American Horror Story and all that jazz. Like, he's that dude, that guy. And so I was like, I could see the edges of, like, really, really good ideas, things that are working really well, and then some, like, probably could have cut that, but that's okay. And, like, the turns the characters take, I felt were, like, pretty strong for the most part. So some of the twists I saw, like, a million miles away, but that's okay.
Yeah. It's a fun musical. You might enjoy the
I've never even heard of this. Prom?
Yeah, on Netflix.
Okay. I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
A Ryan Murphy production?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know it.
Maybe I'll get a try.
What about you, Eric? Did you check out anything?
Well, we had a not so fun couple days.
Oh, no.
Had to take our cat in for an ultrasound. And he seems to be doing okay. We're having to give him medication 2 times a day. And let me tell you, cats are so much fun to give medication to.
Yeah.
We went on YouTube to check out, hey, let's watch how to do it. And these people are like, here, it's just like that. It's like, that's not how you give medication. We finally found this one where a lady's like, I'm going to show you what it's really like to give medication to a cat. And she's like, wrap him in a blanket, and the cat runs away, wrap, it runs away. He's like, yes, that's how it's like. But he seems to be doing quite better today, even. So hoping for that. So on the non-depressing sound, I did watch, which one of these do I want to talk about first? Porno, the Fangoria film.
I want to see that.
I thought you watched that a while back. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
No, you'd mentioned it, and it just kept pushing back. And so I was like, oh, man. as I'm doing my 2020 rundown. And I can tell you, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too.
It's not great, but it's not anything more or less than it should be. You know, I mean, I
thought it was a really fun movie saddled with a very poor title.
Yeah, the title is, and it doesn't work for the film either.
No.
It's like, and it leaves a few weird things hanging. Like the boss thing seems to just be, pardon the pun, clipped and done. And, but I thought all the lead people were fun. The setting was fun.
Felt very much like an 80s drive-in movie.
Yeah, yeah. A lot better than a lot of the people that say they're going out to make, I'm making an 80s movie. It's like, you didn't.
Right.
But.
Patty Jenkins were looking at you.
Yeah, exactly. Or early 90s movie. Yeah. League of Their Own and Encino Man were the movies they were showing in their theater. At first, I thought it was a retro theater. Like, what is this, like a weird retro theater? It's like, oh, no, it's time period because there's no cell phones. There's no nothing. But, yeah, I think you'd enjoy it. It's got some crass, wonderfully crass humor and horribly weird violence. But nothing that felt wrong for the film.
Now, if I remember, this is a Fangoria film. During all of the horrible shit that was going on with Fangoria last year.
Oh, the year before. I totally forgot about that.
Previous 5 years.
It might be the best film I've seen labeled a Fangoria film. And I can't think of too many off the top of my head, but the ones I can think of were not
doing. Well, last year they had that, but they also had VFW, which I thought
was a Fangoria. Stellar. Okay. Yes.
Sure. Yeah. Both of which have been sitting on my list of things to watch, but
I would put VFW in front of Porno, but I think they're both worth watching.
Okay.
VFW is very, I think you'd like it a lot because it's very Carpenter-esque in the Assault on Precinct 13 way.
Cool. Very, very cool. I know, because it's hard when you read a premise. I feel like sometimes that's just useless to describe like what you're about to actually be in for. So I read the premise and I was like, and then I watched the trailer and I was like, I mean, I guess I'll get to it eventually.
Yeah. And you don't want to necessarily, sometimes you don't want to watch the trailer because then you go like, okay, well, there's the movie.
I know, exactly. And I hate having things spoiled for me. It's one of my biggest pet peeves, so, yeah.
I'm guessing you watched that on Shudder?
Yes.
Also on Shudder, and also something you've watched, was the Creepshow Holiday Special.
Oh, yes.
Which was delightful for once.
Really?
Yep.
The finest thing outside of the original film that has had Creepshow tacked onto it,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Was it live action or?
It is live action.
Finally.
It's very fun. And I think, I don't remember if it was a text or where, or you posted it on some media thing. I think you nailed one of the watching the whole movie or the whole short. It had that one problem. It's still not a Creepshow storyline.
Right. It doesn't have the morality lesson.
But the rest of the Creepshow concepts were present. The fun, weird humor.
Got a very fun sense of humor, and it is definitely Christmas themed, so get on it now. And it was based on a story by J.A. Conrath. If you've ever read any of his stuff is bonkers. So I thought it was very funny and fitting. And I liked it quite a bit.
And
Craig were texting back and forth about it. And I was like, the holiday special, that piece of shit animated thing. And you were like, no, this just came out. So I watched it and I was so happy I did.
Aww.
Yeah, it's well worth seeing.
How is it, like a half hour long thing? Or?
Feels like it's a little longer than that.
And it's just one story.
I think it's 40 some odd minutes. Because I remember, I think Craig mentioned it and I looked it up. Oh, it's only like 40 minutes. I'll watch it right now. So I just watched it right away. And it's a perfect length. It's kind of like we talk about The Mandalorian does the right length. This is maybe the right length for this too.
Right. Yeah.
I also checked out like a fresh to Christmas film launched on Christmas. The movie Soul, which did come out on Disney. Actually, Disney.
Right.
Oh, yeah. The Pixar?
Yep. The new Pixar piece that just dropped. Done by the exact same dude who did Inside Out. Very similar vibes, kind of a different side of psychology, I'd say.
Oh.
equally fascinating. I didn't like it as much as Inside Out. It didn't quite resonate with me quite as strong, but the story is super solid. I mean, it's a Pixar movie. You
yeah, can't, they got gonna it mess down. That up. So, did it make you cry?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
But I mean, the thing is, when I'm not in a movie theater, the chances I'm going to cry are like significantly reduced.
Oh, really?
So,
oh,
okay. Yeah.
Not for me.
I need to, like, that's the way in which I can get fully immersed. And if I see, like, a lamp or, like, something flickering in a window or whatever, I kind of come out in and out a little bit more, so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Cry at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, if it's a Pixar movie and I don't cry at some point, there's some, but I don't think that's possible.
I think
except
you
for
will
maybe Cars.
100% cry. Like, for real. Like, did either of you get a chance to check it out?
No, I just saw the other day that it was existent. I went, oh,
yes, yeah, it super fun, really nicely done, and definitely a different type of story. I love that Pixar is now delving more and more into minority voices.
Yeah,
and mm-hmm. they'd already done the Day of the Dead movie, which I love.
Coco,
that's one I haven't seen yet either.
Oh my god, Coco is probably one of the best films I've just seen. Period. It's so strong, and it weirdly like makes you care about certain things that you don't otherwise care about. And I feel like that takes a lot for a film to be like, oh my god, I care about my family history. I don't know why, but I do.
Wild. That's cool.
So yeah. Definitely recommend checking it out.
Yeah, I missed it because after Wonder Woman, I got online and furiously wrote a bunch of hate speech and threatening letters to women everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, it's what I would have done too. Just Googled women, comma, full moon, comma, period, comma, Wonder Woman. And then just find the first link and just start talking about how much you hate people.
That's how it went. I typed in, you know, women, WIMMERN, and it comes up, did you mean women? I was like, oh, yeah, that, forget that that's thing. How they, that's how they like to be.
Yes.
I'm just going to take a quick note on one I watch before mm-hmm. I continue because I don't want to talk about it very long. But the holiday season film that had the guy from Schitt's Creek and
right, yeah, I think I talked about it.
You nailed it.
Oh yeah,
you're dead on correct about that. There's no way in hell she should have ended up with the women she ended up with. And I watched that with Dina. You know, because we both like Schitt's Creek and it's a romantic comedy. Watch it with the wife. She's like. At the end, she's like, what the hell was she doing with that horrible person?
Right?
Like, that was a terrible ending.
Aubrey Plaza's just waiting for you.
Yes. It's
like she would have been so much better.
Yeah, that was so. He was great. The guy from Schitt's Creek was great. But the rest was fairly mediocre and a whole bunch of, like, you know, a lot of that. You see a movie like that where, you know, they're setting it up for redemption later on. They went too far. With the being dickheads.
Yeah.
And by the time they hit the fair, I mean, the redemption's like the last 4 minutes of the movie or something.
Yeah.
And by that time, like, I'm done with all of these characters.
Right. Like they don't give you enough of a reason for why she's behaving as badly as she does. Mm-hmm. Mackenzie Davis's character. And it's just like, I don't care. She doesn't have a good enough reason. This is a stupid reason. I mean, it's a good reason for a certain amount. And then after that, it's like, no, you're just a bad, toxic human being. And Kristen Stewart deserves better. Jeez, too many names. But
I mean, it's a dead solid reason, but not the way it's carried out. There's about five times in that movie she should have come out to her parents.
Yeah, completely. And so it just gets more and more like, this is a bad human being.
Yeah. And another one that I know you've seen as well that I think was okay. But Random Acts of Violence.
Yeah, that one was, I felt let down by that one, actually.
I know Grey's Anatomy has come up here. You're a watcher, right? Grey's Anatomy?
I've seen only the episodes other women have made me see.
I think it's great. I love the show. Jesse Williams, who's one of the main characters in Grey's, is one of the main characters in that. And he's good.
Was Eric one of the other women that made you watch?
That's right. Have I got some episodes to watch for you to watch?
I've seen at least the first season and several key pivotal episodes along the way, of which I had no actual attachment.
I was going to say, that doesn't work for a show like that.
It doesn't work at all. I was like, why is this so sad? The music is really upsetting right now, but I'm not connected to any of these people.
Yeah, no, that doesn't work at all. But I got to say, that statement I made that Jay, how do you say his name? Burchell?
Jay Baruchel
made about it being he's tired of these films that aren't scary and they're just like, yeah, your movie's not scary at all. This is not a remotely, it's maybe occasionally a little creepy. It does some fairly inventive and well-done kills, I guess. I mean, the violence is a good slasher film, but there's not enough of it. It's like, be a slasher film or be a dramatic killer movie. It's
a real fine line to be a filmmaker and a critic of other films. Like, if you're going to be super vocal about like what people mess up and what people are good at, then you better
be Del Toro or somebody like that who comes out and says, I don't think you're doing good fantasy scary movies. Here, let me show you.
Right.
You go, okay, yeah, all right.
And the funny thing is, like, Del Toro would never do that.
No, you're never going to hear from the people who are making real movies.
Yeah, no real good filmmaker would ever do that. Well, mostly. So, it's just so frustrating that, like, I think it's just people who are feeling nervous about themselves and they just lash out. So,
also, really poor timing on him saying that when we've had just a fucking gold mine of great horror lately.
Yeah, no kidding.
So good. I'm not thrilled about COVID and lockdown and everything, but like it has given a voice and an opportunity to so many films. Like when you see that Amazon carousel, you're getting indie films right next to AAA blockbusters just flipping around and you're like, I don't know, whatever. This one looks good. Yep. And just the full opportunity of what's been coming out has been just incredible, incredible stuff.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. I'm writing this down. You're not thrilled with COVID.
Hey, you know what? Don't tell COVID I said
okay,
right. Please.
Edit that out.
It's coming for you now.
Normally, this would be the time where we take a break, but you guys, nobody's going to talk about the finale of The Mandalorian?
Oh, my God. Well, I'm glad you brought it up.
I thought for some reason we'd already talked about it.
No, I think you wanted to talk about it, but neither of us had seen it. And so you said we have to talk about it later or something. I don't know.
Who knows?
Is that one happen?
Could be. Who knows? But we've all seen it now.
Bald-faced liar. I never said that.
The key to a good lie is you give just enough. Like I said, I thought we talked about it and you just leave it there.
Right.
You don't add all the details.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that part.
Gonna have to learn how to lie from Eric.
I'm a little.
One of the worst liars in the
world. I'm a little punchy tonight, so just roll with me here. So yeah, Mandalorian. Are we gonna spoil it for everybody who hasn't seen it?
Well, I mean, if this is coming out on New Year's Eve, guys, Happy New Year's, everybody.
Happy New Year.
And that means that the show will have happened 2 weeks ago.
That's true.
Yeah.
And I don't think we need to spoil it, but.
I don't know how to not spoil it.
Were you satisfied with it?
Okay, that's fair. Yes and no.
No?
Really?
There was a lot I really liked, but every time we get a little bit fan servicey, like the second to last episode, I thought was kind of weak sauce.
I did too. I thought so too.
Really short feeling, and it felt like it was almost like a bridge to some kind of other story. I felt like kind of no real thing happened.
His helmet in front of everybody.
But he already did that once.
But now he's done it twice.
The first time this season.
Yeah, he did it in the first season too.
I already know what Pedro looks like, so I don't care. But the final episode, there was a lot I liked about it. I did see a lot of it coming, just because I'm not a fan of Star Wars. I love a lot about Star Wars, but I'm not like religious about it, and I was still like, oh, I know what that means, oh, I know what that thing is, sure. Oh, I know where that is before reveals happened. And so yeah, there were things I liked and there were other things I was like, there's a lot of Boba related stuff that I don't really care too much.
Did you watch through the end credits?
I think so.
The post-credit.
Maybe you didn't, because there's a reason there's a lot of Boba Fett stuff.
Oh, because they're coming out with another show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't want to see it. It's going to be bad.
Wow, holy cow.
I'm sorry. They're going to put out 2,000 Star Wars things and half-baked, quickly put out by whoever, and maybe one or two will be good. Let's see which one. It's probably the ones that they didn't creative control to death. And Boba Fett's going to be one that they creative control to death.
Who would have thought we'd get a Vanessa rant on a very highly regarded show?
Yeah, no kidding.
It's not about Mandalorian. Mandalorian's amazing. I'm just saying, like, I'm not enthused, and we shall see, but I'm not holding my breath. I mean, it was fun. I liked the sequence. The sequence was fun.
First of all, I think it's super important that he took off his helmet in that scene.
Yes.
And it
shows that it's that his belief system is breaking down.
I do agree with you there.
I was like, oh, okay, we're seeing him turn into somebody different, which I always think is interesting.
Yeah.
And then the fan service-y ending was something that if I had been told it was going to happen, I would have railed against. But finding it out as I was watching it, I was like, I had no idea I needed this as badly as
I did. Right.
I loved that ending. I thought it was freaking great. Yeah. I don't have a problem with Mandalorian giving fan service because I don't think they do it very often.
That's true. It's very sprinkled.
It's in there, but they don't do it very often. And this was story perfect.
Yeah, no.
For a fan service moment that it was.
It's funny because I don't even think of that when I'm complaining about the fan service stuff, which is dumb, I know. But like, that was actually super solid, and I was extremely excited when it happened, and I was totally on board for that particular thing. It was honestly just all the Boba Fetty stuff that I was like, I just don't care. So yes, that you guys are both shuffling very uncomfortably right now. I just didn't know that. But no, that I do agree. I think the ending, it felt so good when the reveal occurred, and I was like, fuck yes.
Yeah. I also am of the mind that Star Wars, for being set in a galaxy a long, long time ago and far, far away, it must be a very tiny galaxy because the same people keep bumping into each other all the time. And I don't love that. Mm-hmm. And I liked The Mandalorian for not having a connection to the Skywalker saga. So when they brought in Boba Fett, I was kind of like, eh. But I felt like they did him very well.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, okay, I'll be fine with this.
I think I just wanted less of it. I think that's what it boils down to. I was fine when it popped up and I was like, okay, cool, interesting, blah, blah, blah. And then he just kept hanging around and I just wanted to get back to the, because Mandalorian, it feels like each one's almost a little bit bodily. And I liked the story relying more heavily on the relationship between the child and the Mandalorian. So when we hopped more towards Boba, I was like, I want to get, once is fine, but then I think it was across maybe 3 episodes that we were hanging out in that space. So that was when I was like,
Well, seeing Boba Fett sit down King Conan style at the end made me go, all right, I'm in.
Yep.
But is he just going to hang out there? He's just going to be like, I'm going to be a crime lord.
I forgot the actor's name, but the lady from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that's coupled with him, I think is phenomenal. I really like her on screen.
I know nothing about her. So she seemed cool, but yeah.
Yeah, she's great in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., one of the better characters. And you could tell the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. training in that one action scene.
Yes.
She knows how to on-screen fight. The part of what I liked, and this will definitely probably drop into the spoilers, but I'll be careful not to say names. But, you know, anyways. One thing that throughout the Star Wars saga, the Jedi have always been talked about being super powerful. And very rarely has it been really shown.
Right.
Holy shit. Did they set up and pay off how badass a Jedi can be in this episode?
Yeah.
That was fucking cool.
I really enjoyed that. I was like, the whole time. I was like, this is so cool.
Yeah, because it seems so impossible up until that moment when he's fighting on that one robot-y dude for so long, so hard, and barely making it by the skin of his teeth. And then they all show up and you're like, there's no fucking way. They're going to pull some dumb shit now. And then all of a sudden, we see a Jedi of some description.
That's part of the inconsistencies in Star Wars because when we first see Obi-Wan and Vader fight in A New Hope, it's a couple of old men that are kind of whacking their sticks together.
Yeah.
And then in the prequel films, we see Obi-Wan leaping all over things and shooting force blasts at everybody.
Sure.
And, you know, and then in Rogue One, we see Vader just fucking disassemble everybody easily at the end of that. And you're like, well, that happened just before A New Hope. And he's moving, he's creaking along pretty slow in that fight with Obi-Wan.
Right.
So they do that occasionally where they kind of,
they just want to like
up their own continuity.
Yeah. They're like, you know what? People want to see right now fucking Yoda flying and doing somersaults in the air. That's what we want more than anything.
I did love that.
Yeah.
I like Yoda flying.
Who knew he had wings?
Who knew all those robes could just, you know, flap in the air like that? Shockingly great entertainment.
All right, guys, shall we take a little break and then we can come back and explain what we're talking about?
I'm not the only one who has a hard time.
Hell, even I kind of have a hard time. The idea of what led us to what films or things in films that led us to like horror and the movies that set us up to go, okay, these are the kind of horror films I like.
Right.
Like a good example would be our buddy Steve Lang loves Friday the 13th movies. So he's going to be and he probably grew to love him when he was really young. So he moves right towards that slasher genre.
Right.
Where I like them. Hell, I own that giant box set, but that's not for me. That's not where my pinnacle of horror sits.
Right.
Right.
So those films that led you to appreciate horror in different ways and films that made that happen.
Okay. All right. We'll be right back and we're talking that.
If you understand.
Lego is here. Hey, kids, look. A whole new world to build. 'Cause Lego is here.
This young boy has such fun. He used Lego one by one. Wibbity-knack-patty-whack, don't stop a plane. This young boy's glad Lego came.
Lego, a whole new world to build.
This young girl has such fun.
Hotels, animals, people, boats, skyscrapers, and more. So kids, get your Lego set now at department and toy stores everywhere. Lego, the sensation of Europe, now made in America by Samsonite, who make it better for longer lasting fun.
We have returned, and Eric, why don't you start us off on this stuff?
Alrighty, I'm going to start off with a weird one where I was pretty young, and it's actually not the movie itself. Although when I finally saw it a couple years later, I loved it and it scared the crap out of me. It was The Changeling.
Oh my God.
Now, I don't remember you probably don't remember the ads for this running, but they ran scary frigging ads.
Yeah.
And I went back and double checked to make sure I had the right ads in my head. I watched the ad going, yep, that's the one. But I took a wheelchair for a rocking chair or something as a little kid I was at the time. Mm-hmm. And I went to a friend's house, and I was old enough to do the stay over at the friend's house. And they had a rocking chair in the room I was sleeping in.
Oh my gosh.
And that got in my head. That scared the crap out of me. All I'm going, should I move the rocking chair into the hall? Should I just ignore it? What the hell's going on? So that film just burned into my brain, and I finally saw it on or Showtime or something a few years later. Yeah. And it scared the crap out of me because I was, you know, maybe a teen at that point.
Yeah.
And I watched it again maybe 2 or 3 years ago and it scared the crap out of me. It is so good.
Yeah.
It's directed by Peter Madoc, I think I say his name, starring George C. Scott. It set me up for loving the ghosts, the unknown, the aspects of horror that are unknowable. And that's probably why I don't have a problem with obscure endings or, you know, an ending that doesn't wrap things up in a bow. This film does. But that obscurity of what is scaring you, I have no problem with the idea of not knowing what it is by the time the movie's done. And that was the movie that definitely set that up.
Oh, my God, that's awful. Do you remember how old you were when you saw it?
The commercial, I probably was about 10.
Okay.
10 or 11. Yeah. I think it was 1981.
Yeah, that is it's funny because I saw that movie just a couple years ago, and it was really effective. Yeah. And it's kind of long. I guess there's moments where I'm like, man, okay, we're still going. But it's just so good. It's just so good.
Yeah, the notes it needs to hit to be scary, it nails.
Oh my
there
God.
Is no other movie, I guarantee you will ever watch that'll have a tiny little kid's toy.
Oh my God.
Scaring the crap out of you for no other reason than bouncing down the stairs.
Even with like a put together adult strong dude as the lens of which you are watching it through, it is still effing scary.
It's all moot.
Yes.
I mean, you don't really see a ghost except for think in one scene you get kind of a hint of that.
Yeah.
But otherwise it's all mood and we've said it before, George C. Scott doesn't know how to half-ass anything.
Yeah.
And given a great script, he didn't have to. This is, of course, coming off of his great success of Day of the Dolphin.
Of course.
A year prior, I believe.
I mean, it built him up for success.
Good point, yes.
Well, the film that I'm going to first go over as well is also from when I was a kid. And also just kind of part of it was super effective. So I remember I was probably 5 or 6, and it was the night before Easter, and we were at my grandma's house. And of course, I have a lot of 2 older brothers, 1 older sister.
Oh,
and one of my nearest brother, who's 6 years older than me, was like really into like all the crazy 80s guy stuff. So he was like, I'm skateboarding and I pierced my own ear and I'm wearing like heavy metal t-shirts and like I've got all the Garbage Pail Kids things. And like, to me, as like a little kid, all of it was like intense.
Sure.
And so he's flipping the channels and he settles on Critters. And I, for years, had only seen like this one, maybe 20-minute segment of Critters. And I, bear in mind, I didn't get into horror properly until much, much later in life. But this was just so fitting with my idea of what horror was for so long. Just monsters that were crazy and teeth and who even knows what's going on in the movie. And I think it definitely set up my love of monsters and creature effects later when I was old enough to really get it. I was like, man, this is phenomenal. Good job, guys. Like, I'm just so impressed. And as a kid, it just was one of the many things that kind of added up to this concept of a horror film for me.
Nice.
It's a movie that I hated when I saw it. And then as a much older adult, I saw it again and I was like, what was wrong with me as a kid? Yeah. I was a snooty motherfucker or something. Because that is a fun, fun movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the first time, I've only seen it once all the way through. And I was like, oh, this is super slapstick.
Yes.
So I do need to give it another watch through knowing the tone better. Because I was expecting it to be really scary having that memory of it.
Yeah, that's great.
Like, oh, huh. Okay. Bounty hunters are looking for these little fun hairy dudes who are just biting people and whatever, turning into balls. So, one fun fact I did find about this film, though, 2 thumbs up.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ebert could be stingy with a thumbs up on horror. Mm-hmm. So that's nice to hear.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was like, man, this is... I'm constantly shocked by what got the praise of Mr. Ebert. Cool, you know, whatevs, but.
Well, I chose in my 5th spot from 1984, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh,
nice. Yeah.
There's something about this film that really hit me at the right time. I was 15 in 1984. I didn't see it in the theater, so I would have seen it rental, probably VHS rental, you know, whatever, 8 months, 9 months later, since that's how long it took. Just a couple of little things on this. It had a budget of $1.8 million and a box office of $26 million.
Whoa.
And Rotten Tomatoes is 94% on this film.
Damn right, man. It's a good movie.
It was written and directed by Wes Craven, who previously had done Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes and Swamp Thing. And then, of course, he followed this with a number of films, most notably Scream, which kind of skewered the whole thing he had set up there. Mm-hmm. This movie hits me way harder than, say, Halloween or Friday the 13th, you know, which had come out just prior to these, because of the supernatural element. I don't like slashers in general, and maybe that's just because I don't want an actual slasher to kill me or something like that, and this mm-hmm. felt a little safer, but it was also cooler. The photography was super cool. It had that weird dream logic through it. The sing-songy voices of the kids and everything were super creepy. There's the brilliant, where they set up Amanda Wiss as the lead character, and then she's the first one that gets killed. And, of course, they do that again with Scream. And the gore, the bizarre camera angles, this brought me firmly into horror. I mean, prior to this, I was still into Star Wars, Roger Zelazny's Knights in Amber series and all of that stuff. I was a big Stephen King reader, but as far as films went, I never thought that they were as scary. And sure. This one fucking nailed it home, I thought. I was just like, wow, okay, terrified.
Wow, you had such an opposite experience to me. You're like, movies ain't be scary. Then you're like, whoa, wait, scary. And I was like, man, movies are terrifying. I don't want to see a single one of these suckers.
The horror of these fuzzy little creatures, damn it.
Hey, man, it was all terrifying. Skateboarding was terrifying. Everything was big and loud and scary. Bear in mind, I spent first grade hiding underneath a desk. So...
That's staying away from those nukes. You're a lot older than you look.
That's such a good pick, Kelly.
That was on my
kill to be that young and that time, like being a teenager when that came out. Oh, that's so cool.
That was on my list. Perfect. The I didn't pick it, but it was one that was like that scene of the body bag in the hall.
So scary.
God, that is so amazing. The problem is, it's a flat-out horror film, and then for some reason, all the sequels decided to turn him into this weird
comedy
clown.
Yeah, it was very strange that they did that, and you know, I don't care for many of the sequels, no. But that first movie is scary, and he's given very little to say.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of lines that he's got, and his raspy voice, and it just all worked so beautifully, I thought.
Yeah.
For my next one here, because I'm going more in chronological order, was some film we've probably talked about before. Came out in 1982. Carpenter's The Thing.
What? The Thing?
I don't know what this movie is. Yeah, what is this movie?
I didn't think so. But... I didn't know if we were doing Rotten Tomatoes or not.
No. I only did it because I think that it matters with the movies I picked.
So this one is, you know, now really high on Rotten Tomatoes, even though Rotten Tomatoes was around in 82, it probably would have been like a 30 on the critic side. But this one led a different aspect of horror. I'm the only one of the three of us that's watched a lot of the extreme stuff and is interested in that. And I think that came from this. Because I saw this very young, would have been 13 or 14 probably on HBO. So it was full on, or Showtime. We didn't have HBO, we had Showtime. But full uncut. And my parents were very much like, how can you handle watching this stuff? It's like, you got freaked out by Dirty Harry. I'm like, Dirty Harry's real.
Right, right.
But the idea of Dirty Harry is real. But the idea that they thought it was interesting, that I could handle this real intense and heavy gore stuff, probably hit me in a way that I'm like, oh, well, let's see how much I can handle. And so that in Twin Falls, there wasn't a lot of that to find, because you're not going to find anything much more intense than The Thing at your local Idaho video store.
Sure.
So when I moved to Seattle and discovered Scarecrow, I started seeing what they had, and, you know, Necromantic and, to a lesser extent, Delamorte. That's more conceptually than actually brutal, but Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, all these films that really, really push the boundaries of what can still be a good film, even while going way over the top with your content. And I think that's the film that led me to that way.
Wow, that's really interesting too, because I definitely don't go towards those extremes, but I love that you were like kind of pushing yourself with this and going, what else can I do? What else can I see? How far can we go? So my next film is actually, jumping in time as well. I'm also kind of doing a chronological, Kelly. So
okay. Not me.
To leave you out.
Not me.
when I definitely was avoiding horror for many, many years, but when I was 16, I went to a midnight screening of a film I knew literally nothing about. I was dragged there by my cousins who have basically only watched very tame films and couldn't play any of the scary video games or anything. And so I was like, I'm sure whatever I'm seeing is just fine. And lo and behold, I went to see Blair Witch, completely blind, no idea what was going on. I definitely wasn't one of the people where when it ended, I thought, oh my God, it's real, because they had a credit sequence. So I was smart enough to be like, but there's a credit sequence.
Well, if you hadn't been exposed to all the advertising and stuff that set it up.
I didn't have any of it.
They ran easily, and I think to this day, probably the best online advertising campaign of any film ever released. And so a lot of people walked in there thinking it was real.
Right.
And the credits were, you know, just the people that put the footage together something.
They're the ones who dug it up or whatever. And yeah, and it's interesting because I did have a little look, and online, their website is still functioning. And if you click on like watch these videos or whatever, a teeny tiny thumbnail video like pops up, and it's so tiny. And you like expand the window, and it just remains just as tiny. And the sound's all blown out, and like somebody's talking, and then a bunch of cursing happens over the top of what they're saying. And I was like, oh, that would be really freaky, actually. But like, I kind of know what this is, so it's hilarious now.
Little quick time symbol as you wait for it to load.
That would have been good, but my internet was just too fast. But the way this film really ended up resonating with me is when I ended up trying to figure out what I was going to do a thesis for when I did my master's on film studies. I ended up doing it on horror mockumentaries. And I think that this just had planted a little seed in me that I was just like, you know what? No one is talking about at that point. Very few people were talking about. Like I was looking at like Man Bites Dog and whatever that New Jersey one was, Last Broadcast. These were the films that existed, not the slew of like.
Did you get Cannibal Holocaust?
I did watch Cannibal Holocaust, and I watched Snuff, and like just a lot of movies that I was very worried I wouldn't be allowed back into the United States after having seen, but it was fine. And it just really opened that door for me a little bit more to pique my curiosity and force me to sit through all these other movies. So yeah, I just kind of got that ball rolling, even though, I don't know, I guess I do have a real fear now that I'm saying this of looking at something on a screen that is different than what it is when you're seeing it in real life. That does get me to the core. Like a camcorder recording one thing and your eye is seeing something different just freaks me the hell out. So,
well, and screens are such a huge part of your life.
It's such a huge part of my life. Yeah, absolutely. I've thought about recording myself sleeping to see if anything happens, and I can't do it. I'm too scared. What if something happens? What if I do something? What if something goes on?
That's fair.
It's too much.
Have you watched Lake Mungo yet? That's right.
I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a pretty good one for that.
Damn, that's a scary movie.
Yeah. Eric, I have long joked that I wish that you and I were gay so that we could go on the Newlywed Game together, because we know each other so well that I would have thrown the thing on my list, but I knew it was going to be on your list. And I was like, let's not have this. conversely, I hate the Blair Witch so much that I'm shocked and appalled that it's on your list.
It's not because I love this movie. It just affected me. I thought that's what we're doing, Kelly. I thought it wasn't just the movies we liked.
Okay, well, there is a little bit of entertainment going on here, too. So think of the listeners.
All right. Sorry. Sorry, guys.
I'm sorry, Bob, that you had to talk about Blair Witch.
Don't forget, I did watch Daniel Myrick's other movie, and we do all remember how I felt about that. So
that's right, because it's Eduardo Sanchez who has the talent. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. At least we forget.
Well, this will come as no surprise to you guys, but I cheated on my next one.
What?
And I have a tie.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like it's a commercial or something or a video game.
No, it is a tie between the 1986 movies The Wraith and Trick or Treat.
Oh, okay.
Whose Rotten Tomatoes scores are 36% and 75% respectively.
Oh, that's much higher than I was expecting.
Wow.
For Trick or Treat? Yeah. There's a reason that these are always inextricably linked in my head, and that's because I saw them as a double feature at the drive-in in 1986.
Nice.
And this absolutely cemented a few tropes that are just my favorites when it comes to horror films. The teen setting, rock and roll, and characters who come back from the dead.
Yeah.
So in The Wraith, we find out that Charlie Sheen is the ghost of a different kid that the group of car thieves killed one night. And he's back for revenge, taking them all out one by one with his souped-up Dodge Interceptor. And in Trick or Treat, the spirit of recently deceased metal superstar Sammy Kerr is brought back to life by one of his biggest fans, and it's done by spinning one of his records backwards, which I just fucking love. And although Sammy is also out for revenge, his fan, Eddie, realizes that he's gone too far and must stop him. So both of these are kind of opposite sides of the same coin. The Wraith is Pale Rider, is High Plains Drifter, a man who has been killed and comes back to punish the men that did it. In Trick or Treat, Eddie has Sammy punishing the kids who have bullied him until he realizes that it has completely spiraled out of control. And I absolutely love both of these kind of stories.
Sure.
The I've come back for revenge, and the part where there's the main character who's trying to stop something that he set in motion, and everything he does actually pushes it forward into the worst place it could be. And he keeps making it worse by trying to stop it. As a writer, these both, you know, lodged into my head, and I wrote a ton of this kind of, you know, short story fiction while I was in high school. So I just really love these movies. I don't think they're great movies. I think they're fucking amazing movies.
Damn right.
It's been a long time since I've seen The Wraith, but we did Trick or Treat for, I think, one of our double feature things?
I think so, yeah.
So I've seen that recently, and that is awesome.
It's so much fun.
It's so good. I haven't seen The Wraith, but I have seen Trick or Treat, and it's so funny because anytime somebody says, oh, Trick or Treat's such a good movie, and I always think of that one.
Right.
Yes.
And the other one, I'm like,
now, did you say Trick or Treat or Trick or Treat?
Trick or Treat.
Pronounce thyself.
I will say this. I'm not sure that you would get what I got out of The Wraith.
Sure.
And that's because, you know, I wanted fast cars and hot women and rock and roll. And that's all that movie is about.
Gotcha.
So.
Copy.
That's a fair point,
yes.
I was 17.
Come on. Yeah.
Hey, man, I get it. I mean, I don't expect that you would have liked the things I liked at 17 either.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? I probably would have been fine with
it. Yeah, there's that. That's pretty good.
That's a lifelong commitment.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you'll know at least two of the next three I'm going to talk about, but I'd be surprised if you know the third.
Oh.
Ooh.
So the next one down the list is another little hard to hear of film called Hellraiser.
Mm.
Whoa.
From 1987 with a 72 and a 72. Rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
The critics got it right, I guess.
That's right. Part of what this, like I mentioned before, the slasher genre, which really dominated the 80s, I enjoyed watching, but never really grasped me, never pulled me into the level. This one did. This was like, and what's frustrating about it, it's almost a singular film. It didn't lead to a whole bunch of like, knockoff kind of films. It's what it is. People have tried to recreate it. They came sort of close with two.
Yeah.
And nothing since then, not even in the sequels. And there's certainly not a large quantity of films that fall into the Hellraiser style, which part of the reason I love it. I just think it's a singular, unique vision from Clive Barker, and it really hasn't been duplicated. And at the time, it floored me. It blew me away. I believe I was able to see this in, I would have been old enough to see it in the theater, and I'm pretty sure I did, because I was a pretty heavy horror fan by the time I was late 80s. And I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't fully grasp what was going on with this film. And I loved that. That goes back to the changeling thing I was talking about. I love a film that makes me go, whoa, 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 hold on. The violence was almost artistic. It was more where Tom Savini creates incredibly realistic looking things. This was art level violence that was so strange and different and not like anything I'd seen before. The "and Jesus wept" moment was just like, oh my God. And the concept of somebody digging out to come back, as opposed to most movies, when somebody comes back, they just, they're there. That's their point. It's like, oh, they're back from hell. And the story goes from that. This was about getting back. And it was about getting back when you put your own dumb ass in the situation that you're trying to escape from. So it's all really just morality is interesting. I forgot the name of the mom, but she plays a unique character for the 80s for a woman who totally controls her world. Ashley Lawrence is amazing. And probably Clive Barker's best overall realized film, although I've enjoyed several of his movies. And it just, it's different. It's unique. And I love that about it. I'm always looking for another film to hit me like Hellraiser does.
Yeah, it's funny because with Hellraiser, I think it benefits so much by not choosing definitively like what country you're in, that it almost lends this extra fantastical, relatable but unrelatable element to it that is completely impossible to recreate. Like there's just no way to make that again. Yeah. And it's just another thing that just layers onto this crazy film.
Yeah, that's true. That's very.
That falls into the newlywed category. Yes. I also would have put that on, but I knew that was going to be on your list. There's something you, when you say it's unique, man, the fact that you've got these S&M angels that are popping up every once in a while. You're just like, what is going on here? And I don't think that, I mean, I was hit that way too when I saw it, and I don't think I ever found anything similar to that until I started finally getting into Cronenberg films like Videodrome or something like that, and I realized, oh, there's this super uncomfortable sexiness in what's going on in Hellraiser, the wife who's cheating on her husband with his brother, and then the brother comes back in the body of the dad and wants to have sex with the daughter. It's all this stuff. And it's, it's all very naughty.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Without being Sex on a Beach or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's just,
it's both sexy abstract. And oh, so unsexy. It's like, you get it to a certain extent. It gives you that feel. You're really, you're like, damn, that's hot, but horrible. No, I don't ever want anything to do with this. This is awful.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, put in the hands of maybe just an American director, but definitely put in the hands of a straight director, there would have been a lot of nudity in that movie.
Right.
And there's no nudity in that movie.
Yeah.
For such a sexual storyline.
Yeah,
or at least no nudity where they have skin on.
Good point. which is like the ultimate nudity, I guess.
That's true.
I didn't think about that.
Really revealing.
Denuded.
Just blanked on his name. Chris Alexander, the composer.
Christopher Young.
Love the soundtrack to this film.
Yeah, spectacular.
Just amazing. Beautiful. Beautiful music that really fits what's going on screen.
Well, speaking of sexy films, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I've talked about it pretty in depth before.
The Fog?
Not the fog. I'm not going to do the fog, even though I could totally do the fog. No, I want to give you all a break, but I do need to mention for sure, The Wicker Man.
Oh yeah, sure.
Because it did have such a huge effect on me. I saw it when I was probably 20, and I still wasn't on the horror film train yet. I didn't know what to think of it. And I mentioned it before, but I hated it. I just hated it. I hated everything about it. And I suddenly realized it was because I'd just done 8 years of Catholic school and I'd been raised in a very specific way. And it was so insulting and in my face and pain. And I felt like it was directed at me. And then I took a step back and I was like, what? Why am I so angry? And rewatching this movie, I just realized, oh my God, it's just so powerful and interesting, and paganism and questioning and not questioning yourself. And it wasn't a horror film in a way that I had formed the idea of what horror was. It was something that sat deep inside of me and like curdled. And it still is there. Like when I think about certain moments in that, it still just freaks me out / excites me in that same way. So, Wicker Man. Oh, yeah. Oof.
This is one of my favorite stories about you that you've told. Because when did you rewatch it after having this realization?
Almost like a day or two later.
That's what I thought. Yeah. That speaks a lot about your character and your ability to examine what's going on in your own head.
Yeah, I definitely am one of those people who I constantly try to assess myself, and I try to be very open to things. And if I am very unopen to something, I like to know why and whether or not I'm actually right. So if I'm right, I'm like, I'm freaking right. Trust me. I already played this game with myself. But if I'm wrong, then it's like, okay, what is up? What is going on? And this film, I mean, I was so angry and I had a huge fight with the guy I was dating at the time over it, like just enormous blowout over this film. And then he went off to work the next day and I was like, okay, what's going on? Pop it back in. Let's see. And I think I saw it like 3 or 4 times, just like in those couple of days, just trying to wrap my head around it. And by the end of that, I feel like it was like baptism through fire. Like I came out the other end a better person for sure.
That's awesome. That's why I think the potential of therapy through film is real. Therapy through art is very real. And that's part of the reason I think you fit in this category well, I probably do too, is the concept of giving people a trigger warning for something that might scare them. I've watched a lot of films now that deal with things that, you know, people might avoid, you know, suicide and dementia films. And it helps.
Right.
You know, it helps to look right into that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's definitely a great way to interpret film. I mean,
yeah, that's one of the wonderful things. Like you said, that's one of the wonderful things about film is you leave your own experience behind and you engage in a world and there's a certain set of agreements that exist, but then there are also, you're giving up certain things. You're saying, I'm willing to be, to go through this universe that it might challenge me.
Yeah.
And yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't know. I'm the same way kind of with trigger warnings for myself personally, where I don't even, you know what, like I've experienced all kinds of things in my life. I don't need to know what it's going to be because if it affects me, it affects me. And maybe that's a really good thing. Maybe I need somebody to go through that with me, you know, and I need to see the bad parts of it and go, yeah, it did suck when these things occurred. Yes, it did. Thank you for like defining that in a way that can be expressed that maybe I can't in my own world. So, yeah.
Yeah, I understand why some people want to avoid it. I'm not going to belittle somebody who's trying to avoid that, but I think it's worth looking into. You know, if you find yourself hitting, I can't watch a movie that has this.
Blank, yeah.
And you probably know exactly why.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like maybe you should help yourself along a little bit more with that because movies aren't real.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, and I totally actually, now that you said that out loud, I've definitely been on both sides of the coin. There are there are a few films I will never watch again.
Sure.
But I probably should. but I'm too stubborn right now. But yeah, like, but there are so many other that, you know, I just didn't expect it and just cracked me up inside. Mm-hmm. Not in a humorous way, but in an emotional way. So.
Going deep.
I like you both very much. And I am so happy that you let me do this show with you guys.
Aww. So,
yeah, I think you're very, very good, smart people. Yeah. All right, now shut up. I'm talking.
Right. My turn.
Enough of this deep shit. You know what I liked?
My number three, and I believe my most recent film, is from 2005. Eric, you saw this in the theater with me, and that is The Descent.
Oh shit.
I'm just going to mention a couple of these numbers again because I think it's important. A budget of $3.5 million.
Wow, really?
Box office of $57 million.
How do you even make the set with that money?
Rotten Tomatoes on this is 86%. This was written and directed by Neil Marshall, who prior to this did Dog Soldiers before, then followed this masterpiece with the biggest pile of shit, Doomsday.
I never saw that. Such a bad film.
I'm
not sure what happened there, but he was set to become my all-time favorite director after this movie.
Yeah.
Like Nightmare on Elm Street, this is a scary movie. This movie is scary before the monsters even show up. It's about five female spelunkers who go cave diving and end up lost in an unexplored cave system, having to deal with their own insecurities and their issues with each other. And if that isn't bad enough, there is a nest of blind albino cave dweller monsters that have been trapped down there for hundreds of generations. And it is fucking terrifying. Part of it is fucking terrifying. Well, no, all of it is fucking terrifying because of the whole rule I try to set for myself whenever I'm making a writing script or doing anything is I will believe any premise you put in front of me as long as the characters in the film act realistically about it.
Yeah.
So if it's a ridiculous premise, they have to be questioning this whole thing. They have to be going, how is this even possible? Why is this going on? And these five women are super smart. They're the top of their game. And they're best friends who have a couple of little secrets from each other. And all of that stuff starts unraveling the friendship and the trust, you know, right when they need it most. And that's a super interesting story without the monsters. I think that as I get in deeper, and definitely with my number one story, you'll find out that most of the monster stories I love are actually human stories.
Right.
And interaction between characters when they have to deal with these extreme situations. Man, I think this plot is perfect. I think the photography is perfect. I think the script is perfect. This film is a goddamn treasure. And if you don't like it, you don't like cinema.
If you don't like it, you haven't seen it.
Yeah. I did a talk through the film school a few years ago, where I use this film as an example of setting up tension for an entire movie. Because that opening segment, well, I guess not exactly opening, but the opening segment where they go through that tiny little freaking hole drops the suspense so deep that it, no matter what happened the rest of that film, that suspense is there no matter what they're doing. And I thought that was so brilliant.
You and I saw this, I think, in a break from the film school or something, but I know that we went back and talked to one of our teachers about it. And I remember it was not a full theater. And so we're in this gigantic theater watching this movie, and that scene happens, and my claustrophobia was just kicking in hard in the middle of this huge auditorium.
Yeah. My memory of watching that film is of the theater somehow getting darker as we're watching it. And it's just like, I know that didn't happen, but that's what it felt like. So, that's a brilliant film.
And his masterpiece.
Yeah.
So, definitely. He's gone on and directed some episodes of various series. I know he even directed an episode of, I believe, what's the Raised by Wolves? I think he did
of
those.
Oh, my God.
He's still, you know, puttering around and doing stuff. But whatever magic he had, I think that he spent it on Dog Soldiers and The Descent.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's too bad because, man. Okay, here's another one that Kelly will know, is going to be on this list. And another Carpenter film.
I know exactly which one it is.
95's In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah. We've
talked about this a few times because I was definitely old when this came out, you know, I was in my 20s, and it still floored me. Now, what the looking at this and reexamining part of the reason I love it so much isn't what's in the film itself, because I think it's an amazing film. I think everything works for it. And I think the, what is it, 52% or 59% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes are full of crap. What it brought for me was seeing it in the theater, because I saw it at least twice in the theaters. I saw it with you and I saw it with Dina. And I don't remember which one it happened at, but there was a group of teen girls that showed up to have a giggly fun time at a horror film.
Oh, no.
And about 5 minutes into the scene when it starts, you know, oh, no, the Carpenters and all that scene, they shut up. It absolutely stopped them. And they were quiet except for, you know, jump sounds or something like that the rest of the movie. So I'm like, what this hit me for horror is a couple things. One, how a group of people can be influenced by a horror film. In a way that I think no other genre can do. You go to a comedy, you want to laugh. You go to a drama, you maybe want to cry or feel something, depending on what the movie's about. You go to an action movie, you want to have a thrill ride. A lot of people go to horror and they don't want to be scared. Not really. Unless you're, you know, crazy like we are. I want to be scared, man. Scare me. But a lot of people go to have a good time, you know, giggle and laugh and then drink beers or whatever afterwards. But this one actually scared these people. And that was amazing to watch for me, which is probably part of the reason I love this movie so much. I think it's a phenomenal movie start to finish anyways. And probably one of my most watched horror films. The other part that got me a lot is, unlike when The Thing came out, when I wasn't old enough to understand it, the critical reaction to this film floored me. I'm like, how did you watch the same movie I did and think I could see? I had no problem watching it. People maybe watch a movie going, okay, it didn't really work for me, but it was a good film. I get that. But to actually say this isn't a good movie in That's any crazy. Way, I'm like, how? If it doesn't work for you, I get that. I'm not going to go watch your average Disney movie and go, or Disney TV show and go, oh, this is terrible. It's like, for me, it's terrible. For an 8-year-old kid, it's not. Yeah. But this one, I just think it's a phenomenal film. I think it's one of his best films. I know that's saying a lot with Carpenter, considering his track record from when he's good. He is one of the best in the business. When he's bad, he's one of the worst in the business. But that's what I think the two things that influenced me the most, I thought was most interesting about this film, was the way horror can hit a crowd of people, whether they, if it's really good, when they don't want it to hit them, or how a group of people can watch a film and see something completely different. And I don't get what they're watching. Why are they seeing that so differently? So that was a big influence in the way I think about film, period.
Yeah, it's funny because I rewatched Mouth of Madness. It was the last film I saw before lockdown.
Not really? Yeah. In the theater?
In the theater.
Nice.
In a kind of screening that one of our local cinemas that likes to pick up older films and play them did. But I love what you're saying about how it plays with expectation, or at least he plays with expectation, because there were definitely moments in there where I felt like, even though I'd seen the film before, I was like, that came out of nowhere. Oh my God. Jeez. Woof. Okay. What? And it really does defy it, but not in a way that undercuts it. It's only in a way that adds to this like eeriness and otherness and Lovecraftian craziness that really works for it.
Yeah. More of the newlywed stuff. With that. Yeah. Okay. Cause you know how much I love it. I think it is his best. And it also sets up, or it didn't set up, but it plays with one of the tropes I love, the haunted book, basically.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of that. The whole Lovecraft connection was really interesting. And this goes back to the Wes Craven stuff with Nightmare on Elm Street. There's a dream logic that wouldn't make sense in a regular movie that makes complete sense in this. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're, you know, he just... jammed in like the scariest moments of different movies.
Yeah.
And it works with this very thin thread he's got them connected with. But the lead character, Sam Neill, is fucking brilliant and everything. He reacts the way you should react when nothing makes sense.
Yes.
He's angry and he feels like he's, you know, being tricked and all of this stuff. And so you completely go along with it. Even if, I mean, if this was a bunch of teen kids who were going, you know, oh my goodness, what's going on? You would never buy into that because you would never act that way being faced with those obstacles.
Yeah. I think one of the perfect scenes that represents that so well is when he's talking about, well, if that was written and he opened up this window and there should be a dark church out there. And the lady with him says, you didn't read close enough.
Right.
And opens the other window. And there's like, oh. So, and you're right. He, similar to Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys, his journey, if you drop into Sam Neill's journey in there and you flow with that, it works perfectly.
Absolutely.
Now, it's interesting because you guys both talked about kind of your theater experiences. And, mm-hmm. and this one for me is absolutely a theater experience. So this I saw when I was 25. And it was right around the time that I was like, okay, I can watch some horror movies, I guess. And maybe they don't all suck. And maybe they're not all just scary and exist to make me feel bad. Maybe they actually have stories in them and other things going on. So I went with my best English friend to go see The Orphanage.
Oh, damn.
Now, it was really interesting because I had been starting to really understand and dissect movies and all that kind of stuff. And I was watching this film, and maybe I told you guys this before, but it was just me and her and her boyfriend in the theater. Nobody else, totally empty, Tottenham Court Road, just like this, you know, not a huge screen, but like a medium-sized screen. And I started hearing these noises on either side of me. And I was like, wow, they are doing some crazy shit with the soundtrack. They're like putting in sounds that don't even belong there. It must be some weird psychological warfare thing going on. And I was just totally engaged and loving how this film was scary without being gross. And it was helping me to realize that there was this other kind of film that maybe I hadn't spent much time in, whereas a horror film that isn't just about like the parts that I was the scaredest of. So it was a very good stepping stone for me. But partway through the movie, I noticed off on the right-hand side of the theater, there was this popcorn bowl rolling down the aisle. And there was some movement. And I realized all the sounds I was hearing were rats.
Oh, no.
In the theater. London got a lot of rats. And I looked around and I paused for a minute inside and I looked to my left and I looked to my right and they were just having a great time all over. And at that point in my life, my fashion was to wear these shorts with cowboy boots and like stockings. So I was like basically in shorts and like thin, like black stockings. And I just took 1 foot at a time and gently put them up on the seat so my feet weren't on the ground. And then I watched the rest of the movie. And it was the best horror film experience I've ever had. And I didn't tell the people who I was with until the movie ended. And I was like, by the way, that theater was infested with rats. I just watched them through. Oh, God, it was so good. But it did definitely lend to that experience for me. And I will never forget The Orphanage.
Wow. When I first met Eric, he was also going through the shorts, stockings, and cowboy boot
sure,
face.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it was
I like the red cowboy boots.
Right. Right.
I like had the black ones, but I get it. I get it for sure. Sometimes you got to pop.
I was inspired by the lady in Footloose. Give me the red cowboy boots.
That movie,
a big one.
That movie is scary and heartbreaking.
Yeah. Interesting because I only saw it that one time because I kind of don't want to ruin the experience, but I was waiting for something gruesome to occur. And I seem to remember the only physical thing that happened was a hand get slammed in a door or in a drawer. And that was kind of the worst physical moment. I might be wrong, but I just remember being like, wow, that affected me as much as maybe having somebody sawed in half would in any other film. And I just loved the way that something so quiet and so easy could be so effective.
I recently rewatched it and enjoyed it and thought, well, why do I love this movie too much? And then it ended. I'm going, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Did we see that in the theater?
I think so, because I remember...
This
Loving
is
it.
Back when I wasn't as comfortable telling people that I cried constantly at movies. That was a horror movie that made me cry at the end.
Yeah.
So if we saw it in the theater, I was probably like, well, that was a good one, I guess.
Right. How did horror films be something deeper? And just like you were saying, it's not necessarily about the horror. It's about the other stories happening within it.
Yeah.
But there's some scary shit in that.
Yeah.
The little knock-knock game they play is fucking terrifying.
And it's funny because you think about it, it's really not, like, it's just some kids walking forward and then not. But
the setup for that is so brilliant.
So good. So good. Yeah,
it's just like the changeling I was talking about with the ball going down the...
Yeah.
That's not scary. It's what led up to that scene that makes it scary, which is the same thing in the knock. Like,
well,
you
think it's not scary until you're in a house alone and a ball rolls into a room. That's fucking scary.
Yes, yeah. That would do it.
I mean, just...
Or a popcorn tin rolls down the aisle.
You're like, what is happening? I was like, are there ghosts? No, it's worse. It's so much worse.
Yeah. Did you go back to that theater knowing that it was like that?
Sadly, many times.
Okay.
There weren't, I mean, there were only so many theaters and all of London, it's all got this. You just don't always notice it. I do remember being very drunk once and walking down the street and seeing a rat the size of a small dog down the street crossing the sidewalk and going, yup. That's a rat.
So, come here, buddy. Come here. What's your name?
I mean, I was really watching it just wide-eyed going, that's not a dog. That's a rat.
It's funny what we get used to.
Sure.
I mean, as humans, we adapt very quickly.
We do. Yeah. I mean, I never was really freaked out by it. Just like when I lived in New York, I didn't really care about the cockroaches. Silverfish, I wasn't a fan,
No. All right, guys, we're getting down to
the wire.
Yeah, this is where we separate the men from the boys, Vanessa.
But wait a minute.
You're not allowed in.
Do tomboys count? Please, sir.
My runner-up to my most influential movie is from 1976, and it is The Omen.
Yeah.
Just going to mention a couple of numbers here again.
Sure.
Budget of $2.8 million. Box office of $61
million. Whoa.
Rotten Tomatoes have this at 86%. This was directed by Richard Donner, who prior to this had just directed a bunch of TV and a couple of TV movies, and then was given this kind of throwaway film that they were hoping to, bankroll off
Bank
of
on The Exorcist.
Yeah. After this, of course... He would go on to direct Superman, Lady Hawk, The Goonies. Yeah, you forgot. He directed The Goonies.
I totally
Spielberg
forgot.
Did not direct The Goonies. Lethal Weapon, Scrooged, and many others. Holy cow, there is so much going on in this movie.
So good.
It's not just a horror movie. It's a family drama. Mm-hmm. It takes place in the world of politics, and it's all held together by the gravitas of Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, and David Warner, who are just titans in the film industry. Mm-hmm. It's an Armageddon story, and you're there to watch the beginning of the end. Damien is an absolute fucking brat, but he's also a monster. And if his nanny hanging herself at his birthday party isn't enough to convince you, him riding through the house on his trike and knocking his mother over the banister will seal the deal. There is so much tension in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's punctuated by moments of this noisy terror, like when the car is attacked by baboons in the outdoor wilderness thing. That is so fucking scary. And it's because the baboons realize that there's something in that car that they hate, and they're, just attacking the car, trying to get in. And then it's got quiet moments, like when the new Rottweiler protector of Damien comes out on the landing as Gregory Peck heads up the stairs to check on his son. The dog is growling just slightly, and then when it pants, you can just hear the word Antichristo, 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 and it's panting, and it fucking raises the hair on your arms. That's part of what makes this movie so amazing. The sound design is great. I think The Exorcist is a better film.
Sure.
But for someone, this one, for some reason, this one is a little more scary to me, and it's much more entertaining in that there's a lot more cinematography going on. There's more cinema going on in this film.
It's a bigger movie. The Exorcist is a small movie.
Yes. Yeah. And there's something about, man, I just fell in love with the idea of the Antichrist, 666, Armageddon. Is just, you know, I didn't see this movie until, I don't know, I was probably 12 or 13. And that's when I started talking to my mom and going, is this real? And she was like, well, I mean, it's in the Bible. You have to decide if it's real or not. She was very good about that at a certain age, you know, when I basically decided I wasn't going to go to church anymore. I have a fun little fact about this. Damien was originally going to be called Domlin until screenwriter David Seltzer's wife suggested a name change. And I wonder if this was influenced by The Exorcist, because Father Karras's name in that is Damien Karras.
Oh, interesting. That's crazy.
Did what was it again? Domlin?
Domlin.
Did that reference anything else, or was it just a freaky sounding name?
I did. Seltzer was a pretty good writer. I don't think he just made shit up. So he probably, researched names and came up with something that means horrible little brat.
Oh, shit.
Man, it's so funny. I watched this film during that same time that I was doing the Blair Witch horror mockumentary essay. And I watched it, followed up by one of those documentaries, like on the same DVD box set, about like all the stuff that went wrong while they're filming it. I remember just feeling like I'd commit, just by watching it, like I'd committed some kind of act that was just, I don't know. I really was like praying, like, I'm sorry, please, demons, don't come after me. Like, like you just feel like, oh, it's one of those films that gets to you so deep in your soul.
Well, it's the thing that I was talking about. This is a human movie, and Gregory Peck came out of retirement to make this film. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that the remake didn't work. You've got young, handsome Liv Schreiber as the diplomat, the ambassador to England. Yeah. And you're kind of like, well, he seems a little young or something. But when you see Gregory Peck at 61 doing this, you're like, I totally believe that this guy has been in politics all his life.
Yeah.
He just, and his reaction to everything he hears is like, this is impossible. But the evidence keeps mounting and mounting until you get that great scene at the end where you're just horrified that here's this man dragging a screaming kid, a toddler basically, into a church, and he's planning on killing him, and you're like, holy shit, this is a dark fucking movie.
yeah, that's a good one. I didn't watch that one until much later, but really liked it. And I kind of feel like I missed out on a whole lot of horror not being raised Catholic.
I have to say, man, there is a special place for Catholics when it comes to the horror genre. There's a whole, I am terrified of demon movies, and I don't even know why, but there's something so deeply planted in me that when demons show up, I'm like, why is this so scary? So much more scary than a guy with an axe, which is so much more likely.
Well, this one is not scary.
100% more likely.
Yeah. Well, more likely.
Yes, well.
I'm going to go with 99. Just in case. So this is a very weird one that is 2007, so fairly recent. And as soon as I say the director, I'm giving it away.
This is your number one.
No, this is... I didn't rank them number one. Okay. I just put them as, this is the film that sent me...
I see.
Into liking horror this way.
Okay.
I think both ways are perfectly great ways of looking at what horror.
You would think that because you're doing it wrong. So you have to say that.
Like in fairness, I'm also doing it wrong then. So.
Outlier. But this film opened me up to a whole new world of horror films, which has become one of my favorite areas of horror film. It was directed by Bruno Mattei, and it's Island of the Living Dead.
So good.
I do not know this film.
Oh, it's garbage. This was the film that Kelly and I watched at AF. Okay. We went down there to kid ourselves into thinking we could sell a film at AFI. But I never liked, I never understood the so bad it's good thing. I never even really liked the Mystery Science Theater shows because I was, I guess, snobbish enough about film. It's like, well, if it's crappy, I don't even want to make fun of it. I just don't want to waste my time watching this crappy film.
Sure.
This all changed watching Island of the Living Dead at AFI, where I laughed my ass off. It was so much fun. And there's what, you, me, and a couple agents who left like, what, 15 minutes in at most?
They were there to actually probably, you know, purchase the film, and they made a decision very early on.
Yes. We had no interest in purchasing the film. So these people paid a lot of money for two of us to sit there and enjoy ourselves, because it costs a lot of money to screen at AFI.
Yeah.
It opened up to a totally different way of looking at films. And it's a very bad films. You know, the bad films made to be bad films sometimes can still be entertaining, but it's not the same as this unbelievable passion that some of these directors obviously had in making whatever the hell they were going to make. And it's a terrible film, but it is so entertaining and it's so much fun to watch. And now I've got like 5 or 6 Bruno Mattei Blu-ray. I've got all this stuff.
He's like your favorite director now or something.
One of them, man. I love watching this guy's stuff. He's directed so much stuff, though. It's kind of, you know, there's stuff that's not worth considering watching. But the stuff that is like Severin or Vinegar or have put out is worth watching. So this, I like this one because it opened a whole new field of films for me to watch and enjoy in a way that I had not before. And so that's why it's on my list.
Oh, I love that. Now I wish I'd done something like that, because there is also equally for me a part that at some point I was like, you know what? Like B movies and garbage horror movies can be so good.
Yeah. Yep. And this is below that probably.
This falls into that newlywed thing in a different way, in that okay. I just realized, except for The Changeling, I think I've seen every one of your films with you in a theater. I mean, The Thing we saw true, at the Lovecraft yes. Film Festival, yeah. and yeah. all these other ones I think I've seen with you.
This is why I'm always feeling like right. a third wheel in your guys' relationship here.
Oh, we're bringing you in.
That's right.
We're what you call old gay swingers.
Noted.
Yep,
dear
yep.
diary. Today I found out. Well, Eric, I mean, I'm only going to kind of briefly end on my final pick here. It's so pivotal, but you've actually already gone over this film.
Oh, okay.
You guys probably assumed that the last one I would talk about would be The Fog, which is amazing, and I love it. And it did get me into Carpenter movies, but I actually don't really remember the first time I saw it. And I know it was pivotal, but like, that wasn't the thing that really opened my eyes and go, what is up with this Carpenter dude?
And what was the thing that did that?
Weirdly, so The Thing, oddly... So it was Easter. Easter apparently is a great horror night day for me personally in my history of time.
Sure.
I was hanging out with my family and we'd finished dinner. We're just hanging out on the couch, doing whatever, talking. And I was like, I'm going to put on a lovely Easter film in the background. I just want to put on something that's going to mess with everybody. And I had a copy of The Thing because I was collecting all kinds of movies to get around to when I was doing film studies. And I was like, I'm just going to like pop this in and just have it in the background and see if anyone notices. And like, I was not paying attention and I had not seen it before. I thought I had not. And I remember looking up and like my aunt being my elderly aunt being like, is this movie? Like with a little bowl of like mixed nuts kind of looking over at me like, honey, what is this? And be going, it's an Easter movie. It's about rebirth. and like looking and being like, oh my God, there are like some crazy things going on in this. There are some crazy creature effects. And I later did come back around and properly watch it. But I remember this really piquing my interest in Carpenter and just going, what the fuck is going on here? I knew I was like playing the line with my family. I did not realize.
Jumped right over it.
That shark was a bigger shark than I thought. I'll tell you that. I needed a bigger boat for that film.
This is where if we were on the Newlywed Game together, we would have landed.
There you go.
Okay. I love this movie for the reasons I was saying. Everybody in this film, when presented with this unbelievable idea, has to, you know, react accordingly. And there's that brilliance in the acting and the writing, but the real brilliance in Bill Lancaster's script is he will set up the most ridiculous thing and then punctuate it with a moment of humor so that you're allowed to let off a little bit of the tension. So the spider head goes scuttling out, then, you know, everybody's just seen, you know, the doctor get his arms cut off, the head get chopped off, all of that stuff. And then the spider head. And I don't think it's Kurt Russell's character, but one of them is like, what the fuck was that?
Yes. We've talked about that before, where he just goes straight serious all the time. Eventually, he kind of exhausts your audience. But that, and there's not a lot of humor in the film, but there's enough. There's a good spattering of it. So, yeah, that's...
Yeah, you need that release. You absolutely need that release. And I think you do see it in also in a lot of Carpenter films, not just in Lancaster, but like in a lot of his stuff, you do get those moments. I'm even just thinking of like things like Christine, where you're just like, that's so stupid or funny or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor in the Mouth of Madness, like with the weird lady with her husband in the hotel and all that stuff.
Right. One of my other memories of just thinking how brilliant Lancaster was when he wrote this is at one point, I think it's the doctor who is saying, you know, this is what I think's happening. And he basically lays out exactly what's happening. And if he left it there, you as an audience member would be like, okay, really? That's how you're going to tell us what's going on? But he then has the next character say something so ridiculous as for what he thinks is going on that the, you know, everybody just looks at him and you remember that part of them looking at him like, what a fucking dumbass. And you're like, now this other idea doesn't sound so bizarre.
Crazy. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a good one. All right. I don't even know why I'm doing this with you guys.
Tell me about
that bigger boat you need again, Vanessa.
I need a bigger one.
The number one most influential film in my life has been Jaws from 1975. My mom took me to it when I was 6 years old and ruined me for swimming or doing anything around water. A couple of little numbers. Budget, $7 million.
That always blows. And I knew that already, but it still always blows me away when you hear it.
Yeah.
Box office, $471 million.
Jesus, in 1975.
The Rotten Tomatoes is 98% on this, which makes me wonder who are the 2% who gave this a fail as a movie?
Yeah. And what possible reasoning? That's fun to do. I love going to like Amazon every once in a while when I'm bored or Rotten Tomatoes or something and finding the shitty reviews for really, really good films.
Right.
And I have yet to read one of those. They go, you know what? That's a really good point.
Yeah. I just wonder, I mean, who could watch this film and then go, oh, boy, that sucked. Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Period.
He's done all right himself.
Mic drop.
Everyone knows this is the greatest film of all time. And it has nothing to do with the shark. It has everything to do with the characters that are hunting and then being hunted by the shark. The film opens with a pretty terrifying night scene of a skinny dipping woman being attacked by a shark. And she is brutally dragged across the screen in a moment that you're just like, holy shit, I don't want this to go on any longer than this. Turns out she was being hurt in real life, but it looked like she was being hurt. It's super scary. I don't think you get a stronger opening in a film than this. And it's hard to watch 40 years later. And it's a PG film.
Is it really?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, my my God.
The rest of the first act walks you through the characters of Sheriff Brody, his family, and the town of Amity. And you get to see the relationship between him and his wife and the problems that he's facing as sheriff, including at the beginning, if you remember, how he shows up at the office and the secretary says, you know, she gets off the phone and she says how the local martial arts kids are, they've been called in because they've been karateing the picket fences. And it's such a throwaway line, but it absolutely lets you know what his life as sheriff is on this town. And when the shark victim is discovered and Brody calls in help in the form of Hooper and Quint, we see another little twist. We get to see when Murray Hamilton, as the mayor, fights Brody on closing the beach. You know, these are ugly little scenes of politics and institution and really skewers what's going on there, even between Quint and the town and Hooper when he shows up and Quint and all of this stuff. It's a film about characters and male bonding, masculinity, toxic and otherwise, fear and honor. And finally, it is a horror movie. But it is, after all of those things, a horror movie. But when it decides to go horror, it goes all the way. The head of the dead man popping out from behind the underwater boat and the shark's head appearing behind Brody as he's throwing Chum into the water are two of the greatest jump scares in cinema. And they still work. My sister, for the 40th anniversary, took me to the theater to watch it. And we sat there in a packed theater. And when those scenes happened, she jumped again. I was like, wow. I mean, now I've seen this movie roughly 1,000 times.
Sure.
So I knew what was going on. And I just sat there, you know, grinning ear to ear, being able to see it on a gigantic screen again. But she was fucking terrified through the whole movie. So I loved that.
Please tell me it worked. To the full audience, you didn't get any of those like smart ass people?
Oh no, this was all awesome. A bunch of cinephiles. Fantastic. To finish the horror stuff, the shark eating Quint as it thrashes about on the sinking orca is just prime monster movie territory. That thing is so scary looking, partly because it doesn't quite look like a shark.
Yeah.
Everything from the camera direction, the sound, the music, of course, the acting and the script are pitch perfect, resulting in a movie that was so damn good that audience flocked to see it when it was released in the summer, typically the time when the studios dropped their worst movies. So this, along with George Lucas's American Graffiti a couple years earlier, set the standard for the Hollywood summer blockbuster, a feat Spielberg and Lucas would continue to do year after year, sometimes together, sometimes apart, for the next 10 or so years. This is the movie that made people really realize, oh, why are we holding back? They thought, summertime, nobody wants to go to the movies. So they put all their big movies, you know, think about like the release of The Godfather and all that stuff. It was all, you know, in the Christmas winter when you'd want to stay inside. So I just love this movie. This is a human movie. It's not a monster movie.
The icon level of the film, I think it's full of things that I guarantee you a bunch of 20-somethings say and do, but they don't really even know they're referencing.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the music cues. And the mayor showed up all over the place when the COVID lockdowns and stuff started to happen. And those scenes with him, can't close the beach on 4th of July. I mean, it's a cultural tentpole way beyond just most films can ever possibly imagine having.
Yeah, the politician who won't shut down something has become its own trope in horror films now.
Yeah.
But, you know, that started here with this. It's just a perfect movie, I think. Now, having seen Sorcerer finally just a couple weeks back, watching Roy Scheider in that, I was like, oh, okay. He's always just been amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, prior to that, and I know you loved him and all that jazz, but my whole Roy Scheider thing has been French Connection and Jaws.
Sure.
So I guess I just didn't realize that he was fucking amazing in everything.
Mine was All That Jazz and Blue Thunder.
Blue Thunder is fun, for sure.
Do you even know what that film is?
No, I don't. Is it racing?
Early 80s movie about, they took two or three technologies that were available and put them all in one helicopter. So he actually has this stealth helicopter, which is fairly standard now, but mm-hmm. at the time wasn't actually something that existed. And it's a cop movie, basically, who just happens to have a super helicopter.
Tell me how much you love Sequest DSV. That's why you know Roy Scheider.
I do think I watched Sequest as a kid, but yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny. I keep trying to think of when the last time I saw Jaws was. And I know I saw it in a double bill with Jaws and Jaws 2 with my mom when I was like 15 or 16. I don't know when I've seen it since then. Might be a good film to revisit.
Oh, yeah.
I revisit it fairly often, as you can tell.
No.
I even like Jaws 2. I don't love it.
Yeah.
But
it's almost, it's I'm fine with it. It had a baby, right? That's why there were two. There was like a mama and a little one.
That's
what I remember about it. That's kind of all that sticks out to me.
Yeah, pretty stupid.
But I had a couple honorable mentions I wanted to
throw
out real quick. I'll just kind of run through them real quick. But Dracula films. Mm-hmm. There's actually oddly two of them. There's Hammer, and then there's also the Langella. Frank Langella film scared the crap out of me when I saw it as a kid. And it still has a couple scenes that are surprisingly the underground bit with the it's just like, Jesus.
Yeah, I love that film. That's also John Williams did the score for that. And that is my favorite, believe it or not.
I can believe that. It's pretty good.
Star Wars and Indiana Jones. Dracula.
And then Amityville Horror.
Oh my
Partially God. Because I really was fascinated by that film and the real life story that went with it. And I remember seeing them go on TV and admit that they'd made it up, and that crushed my little ego.
No.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
So good.
Just love the concept of the story of losing self. And Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Just because it was so low budget. And I know it does not. After Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness and all that, it now plays, I'm sure, like if you watched it at 25 now, it's going to be a flat comedy almost. But at the time, it was a scary friggin' movie.
Yeah.
It came out as flat horror and worked great, but had no money.
I do have one that was kind of, I was kicking around as potentially one of mine. So I have to mention it, even though everyone kind of groans when I do.
Okay, get ready. Hold on. All right.
Cloverfield? So
I'm middle of the road on that one.
I knew I loved disaster films, and there was always that seed in there for me. And I think it really was the moment where I was so embracing the monster movie at like the absolute height and just accepting it and accepting my own love of it. I went and saw it, I think I want to say it was a mostly empty theater, Cinerama, with my best friend.
Motion sickness pills before that.
No, actually, I think it helped that it was on the bigger screen. I think it stabilized it a bit because, I didn't remember it being nauseating at all. And I was really surprised when people said that. I was like, I mean, I guess it moved around a bit. But, you know, when you're like 1/20th the size of the screen or whatever, it felt, I don't know, it felt enormous and exciting. And, I remember coming out and looking out at Seattle and all the buildings and just going, there could be a giant thing walking through here. And the scale of it just was so fantastic for me. So for a long time, it was one of my favorite movies.
I remember seeing that in the theater when Dean and I went, and it was packed. And before the movie started, an usher came out. This wasn't Cinerama or some cool big theater. This was your standard Lincoln Square, I think, at the time.
Sure.
And a guy came out, okay, we've had a lot of complaints about this film making people sick and not feel good. So we have a couple recommendations. The simple one is close your eyes for a little while and it seems to pass. Or if you need to get up and leave, we will be providing refunds if the movie makes you ill.
Oh my God. Wow. What a glowing endorsement. Jesus.
I I like this movie fine. Mm-hmm. I think it suffers from my main problem with all found footage, sure. Especially when we are asked to believe that an editor then got this footage and whatever, you know, what was his orders when he got the footage?
Make this an interesting movie. Don't just show us the monster so we can...
We want this broken into 3-act structure, Bob.
But in chronological order. It's in chronological order.
And look, I know that we just want to see footage of the monster, mm-hmm. but if there's a love story in there you can work in and a solid mid-act 2 twist,
I don't know why, but that never bothered me. Not once. I was never, ever like... How weird that they would like put this together, or that you would never see the monster in it, or, you know, any of these things. I was just like, run with that camera,
I
son.
I like the gimmick, but I really like it when people pay attention to the reality of what this would have to be.
Yeah, like Troll Hunter or one of those.
This was not.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, I just saw Troll Hunter way after I saw this movie, and it was, I don't know, like found footage hadn't become... I don't know. I felt like in 2008, it wasn't as big of a gimmick as maybe it was, but I was willing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you missed a lot of movies then between the Blair Witch and 2008, because there was a crap ton of garbage made.
It's very possible. I mean, I would temporarily for part of a year move back to the U.S. in 2008. So there's very possible, like, a bunch of stuff that I just never saw in that time.
Yeah, you're okay, though. That's... There weren't a lot of masterpieces of Blair Witch-inspired filmmaking.
No. Well, I narrowed my list down to a tight 5, okay, with 1 being a tie. So I don't have any extras.
So you have 6. Okay.
I should mention one more, which is just Paranormal Activity. Could not see.
Kelly's favorite movie of the year.
Saw it on a screen, maybe 12 inches by 12 inches big, teeny tiny, scooted right up and close to it on VHS.
Wow.
Yeah. Whoa, jeez.
Yeah. And sat right up next to it, or maybe it was TV, I don't know, but it was a tiny ass old TV with rabbit ears. And like, just so I could watch it, because it was middle of the day, like up in the loft that I was living in, a Victorian attic, and just was watching it. No big deal. Birds outside, bees humming around, sunshine, cloudy clouds and blue sky. And I just totally was like, yeah, there's no way it's going to scare me right now. And I was just so sucked in and so scared. I could not sleep for something like 4 months.
It's a demon.
Wow. It's a demon. Again, hint, Vanessa. And also, my bedroom in this Victorian attic was structured in such a way that it had a kind of setup similar to the bedroom there. So every time I was in bed, I just kept thinking I could not let my foot lay out, because there was a set of like little stairs right next to the foot of the bed. And all I could imagine is something grabbing my ankle and dragging me down. And I could not, it's so stupid. It's not that scary of a film, but for me, anyway.
Just hang your ass out.
Well,
what's the demon going to do?
Grab my butt.
Okay, then.
I actually had a great theater experience with that film. Mm. Partially because the audience was scared enough that it, you know, helps be scarier.
Sure, yeah.
But the very end, the end moment with the big scare, some lady jumped up out of her seat and yelled, "I've had enough," and ran out of the theater.
Are you sure she wasn't just angry?
No, she was scared. She was just down the aisle from me, so I'd see, you know, out of the corner of my eye, I watched her the whole movie being all tucked in and all this.
Oh, my God. It was awesome. That's so good.
But yeah, Kelly's opinion of the film is very, very different.
That's fine. I was ready to think it was stupid, and that disarmed me to the point where it got to me. It crawled its way in.
I took a girl to that, and at the end, I was like, I can't believe I just spent $18 on watching a door move by itself. But this does explain something you mentioned earlier, which is you being terrified to film yourself while you're asleep.
That is a part of it. And also, I had already been scared of that because of, like, aliens.
Right. So that fear feeds into your experience 100%. With the
movie. Anything. Who God only knows what could be going on. Could be anything. Could be me standing up and walking around. That added to that one.
Sure.
I did not have that previous to this film. I was like, I could just be walking around in my sleep. God knows.
Okay, I'm going to yawn right into the mic because I am what you call a professional, you guys.
Yeah.
Sure.
Hey, before I forget to mention, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is episode 100, right?
Is that why we're doing this?
I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the episode. This is our big Gala 100 episode. Yeah. Folks, I hope you enjoy it.
This is why we're doing it this way.
So, yeah, we made it to 100 fucking episodes, you guys.
Wow. Pretty cool.
Well, you guys did.
Well, you're right.
Technically, it's not, because there's... I clipped off a lot of our and restarted numbering them at some point because we changed the structure.
Right. Oh.
So we've done more than a
well,
100,
I know, because we also had mini episodes when we were in COVID, lockdown, sure. Quarantine, and all that
stuff. But this is our 100th official. Be the three
we're
of us.
We're calling it episode 100. Mm-hmm. So fuck off, you guys.
That's right.
I'm so excited. Yeah. I can't believe it. I mean, that's amazing. Thank you guys for sticking with us.
And just to make things even more confusing, we're not going back to our regular scheduled programming next week.
Nope.
We are going to do a countdown of 2020 films.
That's right. The top 400. We're each going to list 400 films. It should be about 2 days.
Which I know is confusing because this airs on New Year's Eve.
This one? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But that just means we're excited to rock in 2021 with you by just... looking at the past and just reminiscing.
We couldn't do a top of 2020 now because there's still 4 days left.
You know what? You're right. You're right. God knows what's going to happen in the next 4 days. I'm going to have my eyes glued to my screen.
Well, we've been jamming in as many movies as we can, right?
Yes, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
That's why everything I talked about before the topic was 2020 films.
Right. So I think that the way we'll do this is we'll talk about a bunch of films that came out in 2020. And then in the second half of the program, we'll go to our top five of 2020.
Yes. Sure. Absolutely.
And so there may be some crossover. There may not be. We'll see.
I can't wait to find out what you guys thought was your top five.
I know that I've got a couple on there that you guys are not going to have on yours. I can guarantee it.
We're
talking genre films too, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. No,
I've actually been doing flat horror. Right. You know, if you've got a sci-fi or something you want to throw in,
I think I'm sticking to genre.
Well, all right. As usual, thanks everybody for all the kind words. Yes. We hope you had a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, everybody, if you're listening on Drop Day.
Merry Christmas.
This has been a rough year for everybody. And for, you know, some of our listeners, we know for sure have been having a rough year. So we hope everybody's hanging in there. We sure appreciate you guys. And I hope that you're getting something out of this.
Yeah. The frustration level sometimes I feel when I look at our downloads is offset by the fact of how much some of you like listening to us and how much it means. And we don't give ourselves many breaks from doing a show. I don't know if we've ever had a week off in this 100 episodes where we haven't had a show.
I started. You guys have never had a time off. There have been ones I've done from afar, but...
Which is fine. I'm not complaining. Yeah. I think it's great.
No, it's cool.
But, there's two things that make this worth doing. Sitting here at the table with the three of us, all three of us doing it, is number one. And the other thing that makes doing it's a close 1A is the people that listen and give a shit about what does dorks have to say about me. So thank you very much for occasionally giving me something. You know what? I can focus on something and not have to think about whatever going on. So love it.
Yeah. Wow. This just got really creepy, but. Anyway.
Right. You should see what I'm doing to the microphone right now.
Oh, boy.
Ew. You guys.
Okay, so we'll be back in 1 week. We are kicking off 2021 with the best of 2020. Our show is recorded somewhere high above Naval Station Everett at the nexus of all realities and is engineered and produced by Eric Margaret. Our theme music is Strange Eons Part 1 by the band Nightshade and is used with permission. Find Strange Eons Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and wherever fine podcasts are found.